Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's also you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com, Symbiotica.com.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Hi, hello and welcome. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby. And I am your host, Liv, here with the first conversation episode of our Bronze Age and its Collapse series. And I am so excited. So I spoke with Dr. Kim Shelton, who is a professor at UC Berkeley, but also the director of the Nimia Center for Classical Archaeology, which is it's all just so Greek. Oh my God. Kim has worked on so many incredible sites in ancient Greece, but the main one being Mycenae. We had such an incredible conversation about Bronze Age Mycenae and just everything in between. So many of the pieces that are going to be expanded upon from the episode that I released on Tuesday. So many questions answered, so many additional details and like just littlest things that you do not get without just straight up speaking to somebody who has actively worked. I'm pretty sure she said at one point that she'd lived there working at Mycenae for 12 years. Like that is what we are at here, the level of Mycenae. I'm just so thrilled to have had her on the show. And also it was just such a joyfully fun conversation. And I got to ask all of my little nerdy questions about the goddesses. Oh, we had fun. Just one more note, though, before we dive right in. Unfortunately, we did lose about, like, 5 minutes of the beginning of our conversation due to some technical difficulties. We cover for it very well. I don't really think anyone misses out on anything. But, you know, you'll just notice at the very beginning, I kind of recap what exactly was going on at the conversation and then ask Dr. Shelton to dive right back in. Also, just because I noticed when I was listening back, I had to record this conversation before I had been able to write the episode that came out on Tuesday. So I asked questions that I should have known the answer to and now do know the answers to. And I'm going to just explain that right now. I promise. Other than sometimes having to record before I'm able to do a thing, I do know what I'm talking about. Oh, you're going to love this one so much. Bronze Age Mycenae. Not only Bronze Age, but Bronze Age where we can read the writing. And one thing that I was not expecting is just how much we do know about the religious aspects through that writing, through palace records. We know so much. I can't wait for y'all to hear it. Conversations, Things They Found in the Tombs, Bronze Age Mycenae with Dr. Kim Shelton. Okay, so I don't want to make you, you know, repeat the little bits that we lost, but, you know, just a sort of a general kind of catch up for the listeners, because we unfortunately lost just a couple minutes, thankfully. We're just talking about the pre-palatial period and how it was just sort of a collection of elites kind of all vying for this, you know, kind of elite status and rulership before there was a Wanax. And I'm really interested in what you were talking about the burial sites, because right. Yeah, you maybe a little, just reiterate some of that, unfortunately, but I'm really curious in how they might connect to the wider Mediterranean, because it sounds a lot like what the Egyptians did, kind of thing.
Yes. So it seems as if the in the whole mortuary sphere was an area of sort of peer competition and maybe even room for mobility, upward and downward mobility within the social classes. And many of the elites spent a tremendous amount of time on their burials. So well before they died, there were large tombs that were being constructed that would take, you know, many, many years to construct. And then there was this strong tradition of multiple burials that is a way to transfer power from one generation to the next. So you are, on the one hand, maybe you're vying for power, but you want to make sure that power lasts into the next generation. And one way you do that is by creating like a power structure among your family or your clan, that by being buried with someone that was powerful before, that shows a kind of endorsement. And then also the display, the funeral, the gifts, the honors that are given to the dead by the living gives sort of is a transfer of power to those living individuals. Mm-hmm. So we think that's one reason that there's, you know, unlike the Egyptians, who luckily tell us in texts what they believed, that they had this, you know, what you take in your tomb, you need because you're going to need it in the afterlife.
Yeah.
And there we, you know, sometimes we assume that's the case with the Mycenaeans, but we, knowing from later Greek mythology and religion, we know that they had a very different sense of what the afterlife was like. And that may have already been the case in this early period, which suggests to us that the elaborate display of goods at the time of the funeral and that were then put into the burial with the dead had more to do with the living than it had to do with the dead, that it showed their status, their ability to, you know, have more of this. We always call it conspicuous consumption, because you take all this valuable material and you bury it in the ground and you don't give it to the next generation. Yeah. So they're transferring status, but the message is, I have this wealth. I don't need to keep it for myself. I can emphasize the power and wealth of my father, ancestor, whatever, by actually giving all these things as part of a display that all of you folks see, that I'm doing this. And that means all of that is transferred onto me at the same time that I have enough. I don't need that. I have enough to keep going and be even better. So it's this really weird thing. It's hard for us, I think, to conceive of that the arena of death and burial can be so important to social hierarchy and the succession of power and status. but it really seems to be hugely important. And that's one reason they expended so much energy and labor and resources on their tombs, first of all, but then also on their funerals and their burials. And for generations, they came back to these tombs. They would move around the dead. They would do all kinds of different interesting traditions with those that are already dead. And then new burials would go into that same location. So this emphasis on multi-generational tombs translates into that sort of handing down, handing on power and status through the dead back to the living.
That is so interesting. Now, are these like the beehive tombs that we know of from the region, or do those come later?
No, those are exactly the beehive tombs. Now, when you were there, you probably saw a couple of them, but you may not have seen the earliest. Because at Mycenae, we have 9 of them.
Yeah.
And 6 of them belong to the pre-palatial period.
Oh, wow.
And honestly, I would say the last group of 3, the first 2 of those 3 were probably built, one right before there were palaces, maybe was started to be built, and the other one was right at the start. So even the ones that were built later are still quite early in the whole sequence of things, because then they keep being used. And so we think we have as many as 6 or 7 families, very high elite families, that have the resources to build these beehive tombs out of these giant stones, and, you know, an architectural and engineering miracle that they could
incredible. Yeah.
With the beehive shape and the corbel vaulting and the fact that several of them survived till today, you know, that kind of thing. But beyond that, we also have what we often refer to as the middle class tombs, but it's actually a wider range than that, what we call chamber tombs. Mm. And the main difference is they are carved out of the bedrock and not lined with masonry, the way the beehive tombs are. Right. And they can be in all different shapes. They can be circular, oval, square, rectangular. There are a number of them from around the time that the beehive tombs, or what we call the pholos tombs, when they were built, that are circular. So they're imitating in some ways the shape of these ones, these very, very high elite ones.
Yeah.
And many of them, not only at Mycenae, but in other sites around in the area that we think was under Mycenae's control, have some spectacular chamber tombs. They are huge. You could drive a bus into them.
Oh,
they're just
God.
Really, really big. And many of them, unfortunately, of course, have been looted, like the Pholos tombs. But we have some that were excavated early in the late 19th century that have material we think equal to what may well have been in some of the Pholos tombs.
Wow.
So it's like maybe the next tier, or maybe it's a choice to do one type rather than another. And we see that, you know, over time, more and more tombs are built. And by the time you get to the palatial period, you'll have in one group of tombs, because they exist in all of these different cemeteries, you'll have ones that are big, giant early ones, and then you'll have sort of regular size later ones. And you'll have some that are used over 500 years and some that are newly used after the palatial period starts. So it's a whole mishmash of what we think probably a whole clan would have been like over all of these many generations. And they keep returning back to the same tombs. And if not the same cemetery, they build new tombs in the same cemetery.
Wow. They're just so big. Like, I'm just so, I mean, when I stepped in one of those Pholos tombs, like, I nearly lost my mind. Like, I have not been that excited in many other places. Like, and the sound in them.
Yeah.
The acoustics. Oh my God. I dream about it. But I'm just so, I'm impressed that they are early. And like, what kind of time period? Like
what in, like in round, like in round numbers, calendar numbers, what are we talking about? For the early Mycenaean period, it probably starts as early as 1700, 1600 BCE.
Okay.
And then the palaces start sometime after 1400 BCE.
Oh, wow.
So we have 250, 300 years
that
which they're going from. Already they're in the country. They're what we call the Middle Helotic period, or the Middle Bronze Age. And then they begin to develop this more social structure, more hierarchy. And that goes over these generations. the beehive tombs themselves, the first six, we think date to between 1500 and 1400 BCE. And then the last three date somewhere between probably 1400 and maybe 1250.
Right.
Somewhere so in that range.
Pretty
the last
soon
three.
Before the, like.
Yeah, they start right at the start of the palace period. And then there's one that seems to be kind of the last one that's constructed was probably very much in the height of the palace, like during that period. Yeah.
Oh, it's so interesting, especially now that I have, you know, spoken with people about the collapse itself, just time period wise, and like imagining, you know, the last one being, you know, like less than a century, I gather, like kind of before the sort of end in whatever way that they did end, you know, during the Bronze Age collapse. So it's interesting to, I'm just sort of imagining the idea that, like, you know, things went so badly that they weren't able to continue using the tombs, even for those who died, you know, right around the collapse. It was like they weren't going to be able to prioritize, you know, doing the big show what was happening.
And we think that potentially the reason why we have fewer later of the ones, the tholos ones with the masonry, is that people didn't have the access to the labor or to the resources to expend on that. They were, their focus was elsewhere.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of things going on in that 13th century that suggest to us that all through that century, things were starting. You know, the collapse doesn't happen for another 100, 150 years, depending where you are, but the palace itself is struggling, and that it's not going to make it into the next century as a political structure, that things are going to change so radically after that. But it's clear that the mortuary sphere, once power is really consolidated into one group, they don't need that same kind of competitive display that was so important for hundreds of years before then.
Oh, it's just, I love this so much. So I'm really interested in how, because, you know, I'm really familiar with the statuary and stuff that comes out of like the Minoan period, or like, you know, the Minoans are earlier than this, and the Cycladic people and everything. And, you know, basically I want to talk about all the goddess figurines that they have, which I don't know if we, so like, did the Mycenaeans have a kind of equivalent? Do we know much about like the sort of more religious aspects like we do of the Cycladic and Minoans?
We do. It develops in the early palatial period. It seems to be developing as a combination of long established belief systems and apparently the pantheon of gods that we know later came with them to Greece. But they must not have done much iconographically. Mm-hmm. They didn't think, whether they didn't think of their gods as humans, or they didn't, or in a human form, or they didn't feel like they needed to show them that way. Mm-hmm. So when they come into contact, and very strong and sustained contact with the Minoans, they begin to adopt their iconography that they use. And a lot of it is even through small finds, gold rings, ivory statuary, some small scale stuff, primarily seal stones, that for the most part were likely produced by Minoan artists anyway. Many of them were probably produced for Mycenaean consumers, but initially by Minoan artists. So they produce the same kind of iconography that they did before.
Yeah.
What we see happen during the palatial period is a mobilization of religious rituals to once again kind of keep power and to distribute their status, the love light of their status to the more general population. It was a way, and of course, this is true throughout time and history, that religion can be used as a tool to control the masses, right? So I know, shocking. So we see
today on Easter?
I know, it's terrible. Good Friday and all that. It's interesting that, you know, we know from later on being 1200, right? The documents in Linear B that we have surviving from Pylos in 1200, we know that there was a Zeus and there was a Poseidon, and we know all these male gods, right? we still don't really have any images of anyone on the mainland that we can point to and say, ah, there's a god. Mm-hmm. We don't. It's still predominantly the female deities. But there are a huge plethora of them in the documents as well. So it's not like they brought them in from somewhere else. No, they had plenty. They just kind of said, oh, look, these people put them in pictures. We can do that. We can show some of these pictures. But it's right very at the start of the palatial period when it looks like the idea of a palace was actually transported to the mainland from Crete.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, we could have one of these large centralized architectural features. Doesn't look like it does on Crete, but that's okay because we have our own preferences in architecture. That they develop one object that is for consumption and libation. So they develop a standard drinking vessel that's very simple, very easy to make. Actually, they make thousands, tens of thousands of them, not very well, but it's fine. And we see them suddenly start to be used in all kinds of ritual activities, in life and death and the houses and, you know, all over. And then at the same time, we have the development of terracotta figurines. And you may have seen some of these before. There are a whole bunch of types, but there are two general categories. One of them is a female, predominantly female figurines. And the other are predominantly bovine figurines. So maybe bulls, they have horns, but they don't have genitalia. So, you know, we have to say, well, we don't know because cows can have horns. Mm-hmm. But I suspect they're probably meant to be viewed as the male animal. So the female human, the male animal, very likely representing fertility among humans and animals.
Sounds like Crete, too.
Strength. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But these are things that the Minoans who had terracotta figurines, who exclusively really in sanctuary sites, these are very different in the way they're made, the way they're decorated, and the fact that we find them everywhere. I would say the modern equivalent, although my students don't seem to know what this is, so they must not be doing it anymore, but my modern equivalent was always a rabbit's foot.
The kind of thing
that people would have on their keychain and you carried around with you. Yeah. And it meant luck. It meant that it was some kind of talisman.
Yeah.
And it may be that these figurines are good luck. Good luck in your family. Good luck for your children. Good luck for your fertility. Good luck for your crops and your animals and everything that you needed to survive. And we do find them in some religious contexts. But again, and they very likely mean there's something symbolic there. But we find them all over houses and all over trash pits. When they got broken, they weren't kept or repaired. Yeah. They were thrown away. So they just become ubiquitous. They're kind of everywhere. And again, between these two objects, they seem to have a kind of standardized ritual practice that everyone can participate in. Mm-hmm. But they're probably being made in large scale at places like the palaces for distribution. Mm-hmm. To enfranchise people in the religion, to sort of bring them in and have them participate in at least a symbolic way with the stuff that the upper echelon are doing.
Yeah.
And that's a way to curry favor. And we know also from the Linear B tablets that the palace would help supply important religious festivals, that they would provide beef, you know, large on the hoof beef for sacrifice. And then for the feast itself, they would give wine and oil and metal vessels and, you know, these sort of splashy, showy things that they could send to the site of a festival, even if we don't know people-wise who was there, but they're showing a village full of their subjects, as it were, the people they rely on to pay their taxes and provide food and all those kinds of things, providing them a sort of symbolic status by... Here's the palace making this happen. Our food's better. Our wine's better. We have enough for all these people. And here they're going to give us this really crappy cup. No offense, Starbucks, for your not crappy cup. But that, if some of them are even kind of have holes in them, like they probably didn't even work right. But the fact that you were given one and you probably made a toast and you probably drank and you probably poured out some of the liquid for the gods and you probably took it home with you.
Yeah.
That was just this really powerful, successful way that for more than about 200 years, the palace kept people engaged in what was going on. And I think they felt beholden then to turn around and say, oh yeah, I will pay my taxes. I will send, you know, 15% of my wool that I produce on my farm to the palace. And what do I get back for it? Well, I get protection if needed. I get to participate in this fun religious stuff. I get some good meat and some good wine. You know, so it was obviously a barter economy anyway. But it was an interesting way to use, again, standard across time and space, to use religion in a way to create, to keep a kind of standard culture.
Yeah.
And keep people in line, at the same time to make them feel like they're worthwhile. And, you know, whether they were or not, that's another question. But it fostered that feeling that you belonged to this kingdom and to this culture. And so therefore, I mean, theoretically, if then the Wanaks turn around and said, okay, I need all of you to be in an army and go, you know, possibly die, you were prepared, more prepared to do that because of this, you know, all your life generational relationship that was fostered with the central place and the central authority. Yeah.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbionica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbionica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbionica.com. C-Y-M-B-I-O. T-I-K-A.com.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency, where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch, so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
With AT&T in-car Wi-Fi, elevate your adventure by transforming your vehicle into a reliable Wi-Fi hotspot. Connect up to 10 devices up to 50 feet away from your vehicle, making it ideal for camping and road trips. Don't miss out on the fun. Embark on your next adventure today. Visit att.com/in-car Wi-Fi to check if you're eligible for a free trial. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Oh, okay. So many questions based on all of that. Also, you're like guiding me through the questions I already had, like all on your own. So that's ideal.
Oh, okay.
You're going through my list. It's perfect. But I'm so curious a little bit more about the religion, unsurprisingly, mm-hmm. because, you know, I think a lot about the mythology. I think a mm-hmm. lot generally about, I mean, lately, because it's March and I've been doing a lot of episodes on ancient women, I think a lot about, you know, the kind of evidence we have that might suggest that women used to be more worshipped than they were, you know, in the later period, more important than they were later. Do we have a lot of that from Mycenae? Do we have any evidence that they did have any kind of, like, you know, just higher worship of like a mother goddess than, say, the people of Archaic and Classical?
Well, they have, you know, this interesting group of goddesses that go under this general term Potnia. Hmm. And Potnia seems to be, like, if we took what we think was the pre-Greek mother goddess, mm-hmm. right, who becomes Gaia, but she's basically mm-hmm. the pre-Greek. She's already in the Aegean when they get there.
Yeah.
And the Minoans seem to be, that seems to be versions of her anyway, seem to be their primary interest. Mm-hmm. It seems as if they fragmented her up in a way so that she, all of her different things that she did ends up in different people, which is how we end up with Demeter and Hera and Artemis and Aphrodite and Athena, right? Mm-hmm. That's how we end up with these goddesses who, in fact, almost all exist already in the Bronze Age, is that they represent all of these different aspects of life and fertility and animal life and the earth and nature and all of these things. But instead of being in one goddess who might be overpowerful, right? Mm-hmm. You divide them up into individual ones. And then, so the Mycenaeans seem to have, they had all of these goddesses that we know from later. But they also have this group of Potnias. And the best way to translate that is how you might think of it is as Our Lady of. So mm-hmm. Our Lady of the Animals, Our Lady of the Freshwater, Our Lady of the Special Grains, and we see them as Potnia, and then they usually get a qualifier, an adjective that tells you what they are the Lady of. Mm-hmm. And so those either get merged with our Olympian goddesses, or they just sort of die out altogether. They feel like they're redundant, maybe. Mm-hmm. I feel like probably merging is more likely the case. Since we know that later from the Iron Age, we have a lot of merging of local gods and sort of Pan-Hellenic gods mm-hmm. anyway. So it feels like this is where the Potnias went. But it's amazing that we have so many in the tablets that mm-hmm. point to, you know, like the Potnia of the wheat, like the wheat Potnia or the grain Potnia. Yeah. That's great. I mean, later on, she's Demeter, but there's already a Demeter too. So they must come together. They must merge together. And some of them may be local. And went back way, way far. And they just kept, you know, being worshipped over time. At Mycenae, it's specifically what's super interesting is that we have a cult center. We have an area of the fortified citadel. Later, it becomes in the walls. It exists before the walls, though. Hmm. And it's a group of five buildings that each one have some kind of cult function. And in all of them, where we do have some iconography to indicate who might be the deity, or rather deities that mm-hmm. existed in this, for lack of a better term, a sanctuary with mm-hmm. multiple deities. They're all female. And the bulk of them, not all of them, but the bulk of them are connected with weaponry and other kinds of military paraphernalia.
Huh.
So we have a goddess wearing a helmet, a boar's tusk helmet. We have a goddess with a long sword, which is also, it's a late painting, but an early kind of sword. So again, probably sort of heirloomy in the way that the iconography is used. Yeah. We have another one with a spear, you know, so it's all of this female. Oh, and one that has the body of a shield. Who might be Athena. Oh. I mean, a lot of these we think might be sort of early versions of Athena.
Yeah.
And the shield, it's like, is it her body or is she standing behind the shield? Like, it's hard to tell. Right. You have a figure of eight shield.
Right. Figure of eight shield. I was like,
There's white arms and a white head. And this was on a little plaque, a plaster painted plaque that's about big. So it's kind of like an icon. It's something that's movable. And could be probably taken out in certain rituals and then brought back into the inside of the more holy of holies of the sanctuary building.
Yeah. I mean, I have so many like theories that live in my mind about the way that a big mother goddess eventually did become like slowly more and more subjugated into the Olympians that I know.
Sure.
And I just, that's so interesting to hear. Sure. Yeah. The way that they were so broadly worshipped. And I don't
know why they never really came around to the idea that they could picture their male gods when they clearly had them.
Mm-hmm.
But why would that not have been important to illustrate in your mm-hmm. wall paintings, on your decorated weapons, on mm-hmm. your, you know, whatever. So we do think there may be in some of the iconography, some of the scenes in wall painting, and in seal stones and some other things where we think we see men fighting, that may be a story. That may be a myth of, Bronze Age era heroes or demigods or, you know, even gods. And we just don't, we don't know the story. Yeah. So to us, we just say, well, here's a bunch of guys fighting with each other. I is not the way that they usually do it. You know, I suspect, whereas the women are less likely to be shown in a narrative, because, I mean, that's true in the Iron Age as well. That's true all the way through Homer, right? The women are these, like, you know, important characters that help move the story along, but they're usually not in the main action the way the stories are about the men. So for whatever reason, I think we may have more than we realize we have, but there's no way to prove it.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I mean, that's the interesting and infuriating part of working with stuff, you know, this old. But it makes me think of how I like to conceptualize Hestia, which is that, like, because she just is in no stories, like, you know, compared to the others, it's like she might as well not be there. And I think of it as, like, you know, she was so important to regular daily life, like real life, that she just, it didn't matter that she didn't end up in the stories, because everyone in their daily lives was so aware of her that it, she didn't need to be there. But then to us, she feels like this missing figure.
Right.
In a way that, she was distinctly not back then. So it kind of reminds me of that, this idea that they maybe they're not in narratives because they're too busy being, you know, the thing that everyone thinks of all the time.
Right. And I think Hestia may be very important in the Bronze Age, not necessarily as the named goddess that we know of later. I mean, she may have been a named goddess, but she didn't show up even then in the nomenclature in the same way. But of course, her name literally means the hearth, the center of domesticity, and not only in the center of every living space, but even in the palace, and even in these religious buildings in Mycenae's cult center, have a hearth in the center of them, which is not something that we have later on. That's something we lose in the Iron Age, that in Crete it keeps going, that those there's all the way into the Archaic period, there are temples that have a hearth right in the center of the building. But we lose that on the mainland. But in the Bronze Age, we definitely do. So the center of life, probably symbolically in the center of the throne room of the palace, we have this giant hearth. And then we do in all of these buildings, we have different kinds. Some are open fire. A lot of them are not open fire, but are probably for different kinds of offerings, but still considered the center, right? The hearth, the place of worship, the place of dedication. So I think she's there and really important, and everything is kind of centered around her. Yeah. And of course, the house is always the place where we look for the women in the Bronze Age. And that's, and you know, when you're looking, when you're looking, sometimes you can find them, but they don't always leave as much of a footprint as we would like. But some of that is also scholarly bias. So we're trying to improve on that all the time.
I mean, I'm not in that side of it, but that's the entire purpose of my show. Like, let's talk about the women who tended to be forgotten or misrepresented. But yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, it sounds like Hestia, you know, later, right? Where she just, she's just there, but we don't hear much about her because her fire is just always burning and everyone knew that.
Being foundational means you not always, you don't always get to be flashy and have terrible stories told about you. Maybe that's a blessing.
I mean, it feels like, and maybe I'm just so deep in my Women's History Month episodes as well, but like, it just feels also just sort of as the way that women are so commonly represented, even today, right? This idea that like the role of, and I mean, this is not an idea that I personally love as somebody who will never be a mother, but like this idea that a woman is a mother and she, you know, is in the home and therefore like leaves less of a mark. Like, obviously that's changing now, but I mean, 50 years ago, it's very accurate, right? This idea, that women don't leave a mark because their mark really is like the children and the home, but it's like not, you know, it's more that they're the nurturers versus being, you know, something that sort of is remembered in the same way. It's
And, you know, I would add to that, and I would say that it's also, again, the difficulty of preservation. So if you are working predominantly with organic materials and ephemeral foods, textiles, you know, all of that, you are not going to leave the mark that survives for us in the same way as weapons do.
Yeah.
So, and that's, you know, that's our fault for prioritizing something. And also, though, having the assumption that all tools mean that it's a man, which is ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know, we have to realize that women are using all kinds of tools and that we find them all the time, including in burial contexts. And we can't assume that those are male identifying objects because they're not. Even the weapons, in fact, are not always male identifying. But they are in the Bronze Age. They do tend to be more skewed that way when you're talking about large scale swords, daggers, you know. When we get down to the knives and the stilettos and the butchering knives and all those types of things, all bets are off. Could be male or female, because those are really tools rather than weapons. And women are using them in all kinds of contexts.
Yeah. Well, and I think to clarify my point, because I think that's more of what I mean. You're just saying it better.
Yep.
Like just this idea that, like the stuff that women touch either, doesn't get attributed to them because of bias of past, you know, interpretations, or the stuff that they do just doesn't last. And so we get this idea that, that they didn't leave a mark. But what it was is, like you're saying, their mark was inorganic material, both in terms of, the stuff that they created, the physical items, but even also in the people that they created, right?
Correct.
Like, everything that women worked to create traditionally just doesn't last. And so we get this skewed idea. It's just, it's very interesting. Meanwhile, of course, what they were creating was invaluable, like the most important stuff to every civilization, every culture.
Exactly.
Oh, it's so interesting.
Now,
one thing that came up earlier when you were talking about the Linear B tablets and things like that we have, I'm really curious about the god and goddess names that we know that they do appear in Linear B. And, you know, I know they're in different forms, obviously. I mean, but who do we know, you know, was existing as a god and goddess, like during that time, like from the, you know, the later, like the Olympians, I suppose.
Yeah, we really have the whole pantheon.
Do we? Okay.
Yeah, some of them do have slightly different names, but we know that those names are associated with them later on. Athena is Atana in the Linear B tablet. So we definitely even have her name. Apollo he's usually like Pallas, and or, you know, he has a slightly different name. And we know Ares from Enalion is this weird early name. And we actually have a sanctuary to him that dates to the Archaic period at Mycenae in a different part of the site, but there, that he remains being called that Linear B name, even there. But we know it's Ares, and you can see the stuff. Everyone gives him shields and swords and helmets and stuff as his votive gifts. So there's no, you know, and there's things that say Ares, but all over it, the votives are inscribed with the Linear B name. So that's kind of cool, that kind of continuity that survives.
So, like, are they writing in Linear B, or is it like transliterated?
It's written in the Greek alphabet.
Okay.
But it's the name that we know from the Linear B tablets. And then one of my favorite things is that, in addition to, let's say, Hera, who we have a Hera, we also have who I call a Lady Zeus, and we also have a Lady Poseidon. And what I mean by that is that we have the feminine version of their names as additional deities.
Really?
So there's like a man Zeus and a Lady Zeus, and a man Poseidon and a Lady Poseidon. So I don't know. They definitely do not survive the Bronze Age in any way that we know of. We can't really connect them at all. But it's interesting that you have the Diwos and the Diwia and the Posidonas and Posidonia. So you know, it's literally the feminine. They've changed the name into a feminine version of the name.
That's so interesting. That makes me so happy.
Yeah. And of course, we only know them from the tablets. If we didn't have those tablets surviving, we wouldn't know that they had existed at all.
Yeah.
And again, that trajectory, like what happens to them? Are they just considered irrelevant? Do they, you know, subsume to one of the other goddesses? It's not clear, but it's very interesting that earlier there were more deities and more female deities than we have later on.
Those particular gods too, having having feminine versions feels very, very interesting. And this is very much my, you know, feminist mythology obsessed, like, theorizing. But it feels to me like those two gods so specifically represent almost a, like a visualized, like you can see the intent to make women less powerful in those mm-hmm. two gods more than in any others, you
yes.
know, like they are the ones perpetually, you know, subjugating women, like, I mean, assaulting them, all these different things mm-hmm. that are, you know, storytelling, sure, but are so intentionally meant to make clear that men are more powerful than women and that women need to do what men want.
Yes.
And so having them as female forms is, it's sad to have lost them, but also, yeah, like you can like really see kind of what's going on.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And how important that sort of an early Iron Age period must have been for the changes in all of these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that is because we have less social stratification and we have a bit of a nostalgia, it feels like, back towards the palatial period. But yet lots of places are able to blossom in ways that they wouldn't have been able to if they were still under the palatial control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And a byproduct of that seems to be how the religion starts to change.
Yeah. Oh, Linear B is just so interesting. I mean, I love that we have so many gods. Oh, actually, I'm curious about Aphrodite, because of mm-hmm. course she has like such distinct Eastern origins compared
yes.
to the other gods. You know, she's coming from Cyprus and probably from the Phoenicians.
Mm-hmm.
So do we have any kind of evidence of that in whatever form she takes in Mycenae?
I'm trying to think. I feel like we think we have her, but with a different name.
Okay.
But she's not as prevalent.
Right. Because she was going to come later.
But I think that she is very much made up of many of the Potnias that we have, that many of those will end up being the essence that is Aphrodite.
Right.
And it is interesting. I mean, a lot of the gods that were later on are assumed to be of Eastern origin, including Dionysus and Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we have in the Bronze Age.
Right.
So I think we probably had more of Aphrodite, and I think we have more evidence for someone like her on Crete, actually, than we do from the tablets of Pylos.
Right. I mean, that makes sense, yeah.
Which would also make sense, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and it would make sense if these gods like her and Dionysus, because I was going to ask about him as well,
yeah.
You know, have these origins in the Bronze Age and then also are going to be subsumed with this idea coming from the East and just become mm-hmm. the gods that we know mm-hmm. of, you know, from
yeah.
the later periods, this kind of mm-hmm. combining.
Yes.
But that's, yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, so Dionysus does appear as well. So it mm-hmm. really is, like, in Hades, I imagine, he's sort of like the one we haven't mentioned, but...
We don't really, but then that would be weird too, because usually you don't mention him.
Right.
Like even in later traditions and you don't say his name, you know,
right.
he's the one who shall not be named.
Yeah.
And so the fact that he would be missing doesn't surprise me, because there aren't sanctuaries to him either.
Mm-hmm.
And where mm-hmm. we get the names in the tablets is because the palace is provisioning sanctuaries,
right.
giving things to particular sanctuaries. So we either have mention of those gods or they don't make it into the cut if it's not one of the things that they're provisioning.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, so it's all palace records. They're not going to be like, well, we're sending this stuff to
Hades.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's, yeah. So, you know, they're obviously having all these contacts with the Minoans and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Minoans were quite a bit earlier than the mm-hmm. Mycenaeans in terms of, yeah, their whole structure. So do we get a sense that Mycenae was inspired a lot? I guess you did mention already that they, you know, the palatial structures were inspired by them. But I should have looked this up before I say this out loud, but the Mycenaeans end up taking over the Minoans, right? Or what do they do?
Well, it's debatable. It's
okay.
Debatable. What we can say for certain is that during the sort of last couple of generations of the Palace of Knossos on Crete, in which it was existed and many of the other palaces did not,
mm-hmm.
There were people writing in Linear B.
Right, right.
So the administration in that palace were speaking and writing Greek. Mm-hmm. And we see spread out through the island, mostly through mortuary stuff, mostly through the introduction of certain kinds of tombs and certain guide practices, that there may have been some desire to emulate things that we see earlier on the mainland. So there's a, mm-hmm. you know, and there's a bit of a material culture, whereas, you know, 1500 to 1400 Minoan material culture is influencing and inspiring what's being made on the mainland. And then from 1400 to 1300, we have a flip mm-hmm. and we start to see quite a bit of, you know, mainland inspired things then inspiring material culture on Crete, which suggests there's a stronger emphasis on feasting and group dining and sharing, especially of drinks. And the so the cups are different with multiple handles for passing and larger capacity. And, you know, there's little things like that. Even some of the iconography mm-hmm. starts to change a little bit. But there's no evidence that the people just like that they destroy the island and take it over.
Right.
It's not that. It's I would say the markets, the economy on Crete is probably very reliant on the Mycenaeans.
Right.
Once they, you know, in the 14th century, once they start really taking over the trade routes, which we can mm-hmm. see in Egypt, which we can see in the Eastern Mediterranean, mm-hmm. that there's this change of what seemed to be predominantly Minoans showing up with their wares to predominantly Mycenaeans showing up with mm-hmm. their wares. And so that seems to be where we might say the Mycenaeans took over. They took over the sort of economic roots and the economic successes, which likely tied into the bureaucracy of the administration at the Palace of Knossos. Mm-hmm. But I think your general rank and file still were very much how they had always been. And we mm-hmm. still see that in most of the settlements and the sanctuaries and their particular preferences for things that had always been the preferences on Crete. That very much stays the same. So that when in the Iron Age, once the palaces, the mainland palaces are destroyed, Crete always is a little different from mm-hmm. everywhere else.
Yeah.
And there are things that you can point to in the early Iron Age and say, that is so Minoan.
Yeah.
And that includes the material culture and it includes the goddess worshiping and it includes all kinds of interesting things.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbionica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbionica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbionica.com. C-Y-M-B-I-O. T-I-K-A.com.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
With AT&T in-car Wi-Fi, stay connected wherever you go and transform your vehicle into a dependable Wi-Fi hotspot. Powering applications like real-time GPS and voice assistant, navigation becomes a breeze. Even on the practice field, AT&T in-car Wi-Fi keeps you connected while in proximity of your vehicle. Work, stream shows, or finish homework without missing a beat. See if you're eligible for a free trial at att.com/in-car Wi-Fi. Don't let connectivity be a roadblock in your journey. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Yeah. And, you know, you're interested in this battle between the patriarchy and Mother Earth, right? It's so fascinating that where that survives in Greek myth, like the fact that Zeus is hidden and then reborn on Crete.
Oh, yeah.
Right? From a cave, which is literally, according to the Minoans, the womb of the goddess.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Every time you have a god like Apollo taking over the sanctuary at Delphi, he has to fight the python of the mother goddess. Right. Because that's her spot. And so we literally have that just baked into all of these traditions. And we know that this was probably going on all around.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I talk about Crete's such
a fascinating place to watch that happen. And how actually the goddesses remain being so significant to the point where they kind of have to almost legislate to make sure that the male gods are the predominant gods. Because traditionally, for hundreds and hundreds of years, that hadn't been the case on Crete.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think about it, the Zeus in the cave, I'd never thought about the cave imagery. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. It also ties in.
You're welcome.
I've been learning a lot of these things lately where, like, you know, these things I've always associated with some kind of patriarchal structure alongside the goddesses, but hadn't quite conceptualized just how, like, visceral it is. Like, I released an episode today where I spoke with somebody who pointed out that Charybdis is, like, just, like, this hungry hole, is how we phrased it. And it's just, like, the cave makes me think of that too. Like,
the hungry hole that sucks the men in.
Yes, right?
And eats them alive.
It's so good. I love that.
Afraid of women's sexuality much?
For real. Like, I mean, I've always considered her as this like obvious notion of male fear, but I never had like really dug that deep. I love it.
And when you pair that, of course, with Scylla,
yes,
who is a female dog, right?
Yep,
so
she's
you have
a bitch.
The bitch on the one side and the you know, sucking up hole on the other. Yeah, I know. It's crazy.
It's so good. No, and
this is
and
why you love myth. This is why you love myth.
Absolutely. And then, you know, I've been doing this for 7 years and still somebody can come and be like, well, you know, for all that Charybdis is male fear, she's really just a gaping hole. And I'm like, oh my God. Oh my, like, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly.
But on Crete, you know, there's the cave. And then I think of too, the, you know, the whole Europa myth.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's like, oh, well, no, but a man brought her there. Like, that's why Crete had all these goddesses to begin with. But they didn't start there. You know, Zeus had to bring her. And I think that's, yeah, such an interesting kind of like way of rewriting this mythological history that already existed. And then the people coming in, the men coming in rather, like want to emphasize, you know, they're maintaining something that they know was already there, but they are also finding this way of, you know, making it about them.
Yes. Yes. But also the later Greeks too, connecting with what they must have heard about Crete. Mm-hmm. So whether that's Zeus is the bull bringing Europa, or it's the Minotaur, right? Pasiphae and Daedalus and the fake cow and the whole, you know, Cretan bull, Marathon bull. And then obviously the Minotaur is the ultimate, you know, expression of that. That has to be stories. Some that, you know, at the seat of it are misunderstood stories coming out of the Minoan belief system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's super strong connection.
I mean, I could see it, you know, in the museum in Heracleion where you're like, well, okay, there's women, paintings of women everywhere, goddess figurines everywhere, and then bulls everywhere. And so you can just see where these later people who, you know, can't read linear A like we can't. And they're like looking at these things and they're like, okay, like put the two together and yeah. you know, make it this story.
Yeah. yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's clearly so fascinating. I love this part of my job so much. You touched on the interactions, you know, beyond the Minoan. So I'd love to hear more about the ways that Mycenae did, you know, the Mycenaeans broadly did interact with the wider Mediterranean.
Sure. And we know from quite early on that they were interacting, especially with the Eastern Mediterranean. And we see that really amplify in the historical, in the palatial period, where their economy is very much based on the import of raw materials that are coming from outside the Greek world. They're creating of crafts with these materials and then mm-hmm. selling them back to those same cultures wow. that supplied the raw materials in the first place. Ivory is a good example of that.
Right.
But then also the fact that they, you know, undeniably had the best wine and olive oil and the, honestly, the best ceramic containers for them that were in production during that time meant that there was this whole other sort of industry too, where they're selling their own resources and trading yeah. them with the Eastern Mediterranean. And they, yeah. then luckily for this, this pottery leaves its footprint everywhere. So we can find them in Egypt and we can find them in the Levant. We can find them in Asia Minor and also to the West, because they begin to expand also to the West into Italy and Sicily and Spain. And I think mm-hmm. we even have some stuff as far as Portugal now.
Really, and I suspect from the Bronze Age.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Mycenaean pottery.
Wow.
Yeah. And the Mycenaeans wow. themselves seem to have had some, probably not one-on-one, but probably chain trade going on with more central Europe, because we have all this amber that's Baltic amber that ends up in Greece. And then it seems to come out of Greece and go to other parts of the Mediterranean as a trade item. But it looks like something that the Greeks are bringing from further north into the Greek peninsula and then are distributing from there.
Wow. Wow.
So, you know, so yeah, gold. Gold is coming from the Eastern Med. Ivory is coming from the Eastern Med. A lot of the sort of precious stones are coming from there. But then we have silver that the Greeks have themselves, the amber that's coming from the north, maybe also copper to the west. Yeah. We know they were getting copper from Cyprus, but it looks like they were also getting some copper from Ebla and other places as well.
Wow. They didn't really work much with marble all the way back then, did they?
No, they didn't. Yeah. They didn't. They weren't really mining the marble. They were using limestone
right.
that they had, and they were carving with, and they were actually trying to make sculpture with it. But we think this is one of the reasons the Mycenaeans didn't really have large-scale sculpture.
Right.
Everything yeah. was relatively small scale, the exception yeah. being the Lion Gate.
Right.
Which is made out of the local limestone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And it's interesting just because, like, the palaces were so monumental. Like, the palaces yep. were enormous and made mm-hmm. of these enormous stones. But, yeah, they weren't, you know, they weren't making art out of them in the same way yep. that people would
They would
later.
Use some colored stones were ending up as decorative elements. But right. they tend to be softer, so I think they worried about their stability, which mm-hmm. is why they would use them as accents rather than, you know, rather than using the limestone or the conglomerate limestone for what, you know, was sturdy and holding up the buildings and the tombs mm-hmm. and all of that. And those were locally familiar with them. We don't right. really have a huge amount of marble in the Peloponnese.
Right. Right. That makes sense.
You yeah. know, and so much of the later like marble sculpture and stuff actually comes from the islands.
Yeah. Yeah. And so did they have a lot of, did they do much with the other islands? Was there a lot? I mean, I know obviously mm-hmm. the Cycladic cultures were going on. So yeah, were they also
yes.
interacting?
Yes,
with
they were. The late Cycladic culture is very mm-hmm. much entwined
right.
with the Mycenaean world. And in part because you can't sail anywhere without hitting an island. Yeah. So if you're going to be doing any international exchange, you have yeah. to mobilize the islands and use them yeah. to go through. And we see that reflected in the Cycladic material culture.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I love the Cycladic Islands so much. And their art was so different. Like, do we see the sharing of any of that art with the Mycenaeans? Like, I just think of, you know, the big head kind of figurines.
No, in part because that was so early.
Right.
So all of those figurines were from the early Bronze Age.
Yeah.
And we have a few that made it to the mainland, but it was well pre-Greeks on the mainland. Yeah. It was possibly even people from the Cyclades that had, you know, settled in Attica, for instance, where we have some of the Cycladic figurines.
I think it's just so easy to forget just how widespread this was, just like across the whole of the region. And I visited Samothrake a couple years ago and learned that they found Linear A there. And I like that kind of thing. It's just, I just love it so much. This idea that like they were really just traveling all over the place. And it feels like such long distances, like so much water. Like, I'm just so impressed. I know it's, I feel like I should get used to it, but it's just, it's so interesting.
It is.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would be, you know, missing out on a major thing if I didn't ask about what we know about their interactions with like the Hittites and the Troy of it all.
Mm-hmm. Well, we definitely know that they were interacting with the Hittites, both because of the Hittite documents that seem to record the Ahiawans that we think are the Mycenaean Greeks, but also through some technology that they shared. For instance, there's a colleague of mine, Nick Blackwell, has done a lot of research on the kinds of tools that they use to carve the Lion Gate and to carve other things. They use this pendulum saw that was a Hittite tool. And whether these were Hittite artists or they were, you know, sculptors who were trained in the Hittite way of doing it, that's really strong evidence that they were an introduction. You know, they were in some exchange with them, whereas we kind of knew it already. We had some material culture that also suggested it. And then, I teach a whole class about the Trojan War, so it's hard to say in a nutshell. But I think that the point you made about Samothrake, is that both the Minoans and the Mycenaeans were traveling all around the Mediterranean. And the idea of expanding into the Black Sea, which is what, of course, Jason the Argonauts is all about, the Mycenaeans expanding into the Black Sea, is you have this very powerful place that's right there in the doorway into the Black Sea that you have to deal with. And I think that it's more likely that if there was a war, which I think there were probably multiple wars, and not just one that was immortalized in the story, but there were in fact multiple wars, that it was really about trade rights and access more than it was about a beautiful woman, as romantic as that is.
Oh, really?
You know, I know. Go figure.
They found a way to blame a woman.
I know. But that's, I do think that we actually have evidence from lots of places in sort of off the west coast of Turkey that shows similar kinds of things, that there was lots of interest in access to those areas and those resources, tin being one of them, tin and gold coming from those areas, not to mention horses and textiles and all kinds of other things that came from that part of the world. And for whatever reason, Troy got immortalized. It's the one that kept being told and retold. But I think there were probably lots of little Trojan wars like that.
Yeah. So I love these connections to mythology. So they got gold from that area. Like, that's where the Golden Fleece, that's why the Golden Fleece. I'd never even thought of that.
The Golden Fleece comes from the way that you used to in pre-industrial times. They used to collect the alluvial gold. So the gold is in the river, like here in California.
Right.
And you would put the fleece, the wool with the lanolin, the sticky stuff on it.
Yeah.
You put it as like a dam across the thing and it would catch the gold. It was like panning the river for gold. So when you picked up these fleeces, they would look all gold and shimmery because they would catch all the gold. So that's what a golden fleece is. That's where that comes from.
Why have I never looked that up before? I love
that's
that
okay.
so much.
Not everyone that's thinks so to great. Do it, but it's a totally actual real thing that people would have known. But they mostly did it in that part of the world, sort of the northwestern part of Anatolia, but also up in the east part of the Black Sea where Colchis is, where that part of the world was very much where all that was going on, where that kind of gold recovery was happening.
a couple years ago, it finally occurred to me that the reason Medea lives out there and is the daughter of the sun is because the sun is rising.
Yes,
from
rises
there.
In the east. And that was the furthest east they could imagine.
Yes.
That was the furthest east that they had discovered or knew about. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is just adding to my little, like, okay, I got my little collection of, like, just, it adds so much to the mythology. And I think that so often people find Greek mythology just because it's fun stories. And, you know, I am so fascinated in where it's all coming from and why it's all being told, like, so much more than the stories themselves.
Yeah. Don't get me started on Heracles.
Oh my God.
We'd have to have a whole nother podcast on Heracles and all of his archaeological reasons why he's doing all these labors and where they're located.
I mean, he's everywhere.
Well, because of Nemea is my other site, we do have a special connection with Heracles. So
are you familiar with the I think it's the School of Paleontology in Athens, the Greek school. They did this big exhibit a couple of years ago where they created this, like, very large scale interactive display showing how a lot of his labors, specifically in the Peloponnese, align with, like, geological formations and things. I got to get, they were so sweet and, like, emailed me to give me a private English tour of this thing that is, like, all entirely Greek. But it reminds me of that. It looked at all of these ways, like, the Lernaean Hydra, you know, aligns with some geological things happening in the earth. And
multiple rivers yes, that come out of that spot. Yeah,
exactly. And they were, you know, noxious in some way. And so fire was involved. And I just, and then there was the river, is it Achelous? Yeah, where he has to, like, split it. Because anyway, it was just, it makes me now I want to know about all the archaeological connections, because I've got all the geological ones in my
head. That's right.
You know, I don't want to keep you too long, but I might try to get a Heracles episode out of you sometime eventually.
Sure. Anytime. He's one of my favorites, although don't tell Perseus, because that's, he of course founded Mycenae. So I have to have a special,
true, of course,
special relationship with Perseus. But
I'm currently working on a section of a book on Medusa and looking at all of those kind of origins as well. So I'm kind of locked into that realm myself.
Yeah.
Because she is my obsession. Undying. Before I let you go, because this has been incredible. So much better than I expected, which always happens. It's such a joy. But is there anything, you know, do you have, like, a favorite fun fact or thing about Mycenae that's your just kind of love that you want to share before we sign off?
I mean, there's lots of cool things about Mycenae in general. And I've been, you know, working there and excavating there for a very long time. So it's a very special relationship that I have with it. But I would say, to sort of circle back to, we were talking about the monumental tombs.
Yeah.
And one of the tombs that I know you visited was what we call the Treasury of Atreus.
Yeah.
Or locally, they call it the Tomb of Agamemnon, which was the largest one, not only at Mycenae, but on the mainland that we have. And of course, it has survived, still standing today.
Yeah.
And what very few people realize is that in the fall and spring equinoxes, because that tomb faces directly east, the sun comes in at, when it pops over the mountain opposite, the sun comes in the triangle and it refracts off the back curved wall and rebounds into the triangle of the little side chamber and lights it up like daylight. It's very cool.
It happens. I'm so glad I asked you that.
It happens at like 7 o'clock in the morning, so the site's not open. So you have to sort of know about it. So I used to, when I lived there, I lived in Greece at Mycenae for 12 years. I would pop up there and it would be me and the guards with our coffee, you know, waiting for the sun to pop up over the mountain. But it's really amazing. And I would love to say that it was all done intentionally, but I don't think maybe a little bit, but we know that, for instance, the triangle was covered with sculpture.
Oh, okay.
So it wouldn't have been open in the ancient period anyway.
Yeah.
All the rest of the Pholoi don't face directly east. So this one just happens to face directly. So at the same time, I feel like this can't be a coincidence either. They're such good engineers. They must have navigated with the stars and known all about the sun and the moon courses and all that. So I feel like they were able to do this. It was possible for them to do this. That was the full intent of this burial monument. No, I don't think so. Yeah. But I'm super happy that it worked out that way, and that it's a fun thing for those of us who work there and, you know, are able to be there at 7 o'clock in the morning on the fall or spring equinox.
I like to imagine the architect who just made that one just kind of added, like, was like really keen himself, you know, like it was more of like a personal decision, and that's why it's like just in that one. I love that though. I'm going back in June and I'm very glad to have that fact. You did make me think though, do you, just really quickly, do you have any, is there any evidence in Mycenae that links to the later curse of the
Curse of the House of Atreus?
Yeah, because it's my favorite thing in the whole world, that line of curses.
Yeah, like, I mean, I jokingly always say that we still live under the curse of the House of Atreus at Mycenae, because what will go wrong will go wrong. Like, we just know it's a big, complicated, expensive site that everyone feels like they have their own stake in. So everyone's like not cooperating the way they should, which is really what the site needs. So I jokingly, but not jokingly, say that we're still under that curse for a lot of ways, but I've never seen anything from the Bronze Age itself to suggest that. We don't even know. I mean, we have curse tablets later as part of a Greek tradition that you actually could ask for people to be cursed and things like that. But we don't have anything in the evidence, in the archaeological evidence. I do think though, that a lot of these stories go back very early, and that some of these names may well have been attached to people very early on. There may have been an Atreus, there may have been a Pelops for that matter.
Yeah.
So the fact that you have this horribly tragic, curse-filled family generation after generation after generation may be an overblowing of, you know, some weird things that happened to this family who, you know, they couldn't keep it in their pants. They couldn't, you know, do the things they're supposed to do.
They couldn't keep from killing children and eating them.
Yeah, and making them into kid soup. Who wants kid soup, you know?
They just couldn't help themselves.
I mean, yeah. So they're weird, complicated group and problematic group to be your sort of people that you are working with. But I always hope that the stuff that we find and the narratives that we create will be a better choice. Will be, you know, find that in fact it wasn't all that tragic and bad. It just makes for a good story.
Yeah. No, they've always interested me because, I mean, one, they're just some of the most entertaining stories from myth.
Sure.
But two, what you mentioned, this idea that like they are like the biggest and best kings still, like even when you are a child of one of them, like they're so openly proud of who they come from. They're like, "Yes, I am a Tantalid. Did he try to eat my grandfather? Sure. Still am proud that I'm a Tantalid."
Right.
Like, yeah, it's, I just, I find that to be such an interesting kind of, you know, it feels like a, I don't know the word I want, but it just feels weird, I guess, to be
it
like,
does.
Yeah,
and it's a lesson in, and it's a lesson in the sort of Greek, I guess, acceptance of things like arrogance and hubris and things that, you know, they did retell these things and celebrate them. And I guess it's supposed to be a moral lesson. At the same time, they keep missing the message. So, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah. I mean, it makes for great content for me. So I'm not.
There you go. It makes good content for me too. Teaching, you know, touring an archaeological site, all of those things. It's good to remember that.
Yeah. I thought of it a lot in the Tomb of Clytemnestra, you know, quote unquote, Tomb of Clytemnestra there. Ugh. Just those tombs, I'll never forget them. I can't wait to go back. Well, this has been utterly incredible. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate you making the time, and I mean,
absolutely,
it was so worth it on my end.
Absolutely. Well, I will be around in the area in June. So if you are there, send me an email, and I'll tell you how to get in touch with me by phone once you're in Greece, because I'll be working both at Nemea and at Mycenae in June. So I'll be around.
I would love to do that. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me. Is there anything you want to share with my listeners reading more from you or anything like that?
Not yet. We will have, but most of the stuff that I work on is pretty, scholarly based and all that, but They're welcome to go to my website, which is nemeacenter.berkeley.edu, and see all of the exciting projects we have going on. All three of them have a Bronze Age element, but also a later classical element too. And I will say that, and this is in part thanks to Eric Klein, who I know recommended me. My colleague Lynn Kvapil and I are actually going to be producing a book for his series that he's doing, in which we're looking at very much the everyday Mycenaeans. Oh. So flipping the script, not talking about just the kings and the elite, but actually looking at everyday life and the other context that we know. And from the perspective of two women field archaeologists, which actually are relatively rare in our part of the world as well. So we're putting a, you know, how does one excavate with a, you know, while they're breastfeeding, right? You know, they don't talk about those things very much, but we're going to very much infuse this book about, you know, women excavating women, sort of the idea.
Whenever that exists, you can expect me to hopefully, reach out. That
hopefully sometime
incredible.
Next year. Hopefully sometime Amazing. In early 2025 is the hope.
I've been very lucky. I think most of the archaeologists I've ever had on this show have been women, mostly just because of my own circles. But it makes it seem like there's a higher representation, which I know there's not. But I'm lucky to speak to so many. So
yes, that's great. That's great. And thanks for giving us the platform to speak.
Oh my God, it's my favorite thing in the entire world. If you haven't been able to tell from my like enormous smile throughout this entire conversation. Oh, nerds. That episode was so much fun. Oh my God. Like, I just, you know, this is such a thrill for my job. I just truly love so much when people can come on and share all of this stuff with me. It's just such a joy. I'm at a loss for how to describe just so much of the joy. So instead, I will just again say joy. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm sure you learned a lot. I know that I did, and I am just so excited for this conversation and everything that I have to come for this series, because we have another three conversations coming in addition to another two scripted episodes detailing so much more about the Bronze Age Mediterranean and its collapse. Thank you all so much for listening. As always, it means the world to me. If you've just found the show through this series, hi, welcome. Normally I talk about mythology. It's usually more storytelling. Still always fun, though. That's why I'm here. I have some of the most incredible guests on my show. I am so lucky. It is such a joy. Welcome. Welcome. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians. And during this Bronze Age series, she is also the writer. Let's be perfectly honest. The writer of the episodes, not this one, because it's just a conversation, that'd be weird, but Michaela and the Bronze Age are closely tied, is all I'm saying. Laura Smith is the production assistant and audio engineer, and she worked her wonders on this conversation. Everyone has their hands in all the different pieces, because somehow my show has grown to be three people, and aren't we fun? The podcast is part of the iHeart Podcast Network. Listen on Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. Help me continue bringing you the world of the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you'll get access to past bonus episodes, hopefully more new ones, and, you know, generally just contribute to the free show that I give you all twice a week. That's patreon.com/mythsbaby. I feel like I am slightly losing my mind again. Apologies. We're living on the edge. We're living on the edge. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring, and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.